Hello everyone and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
We are seeing an extensive amount of concerning online chatter.
The FBI director sounds the alarm about the potential for armed protests around the US. With hate speech percolating online for years before the US Capitol was ever stormed, we hear from former FBI agent Ali Soufan and Washington Post media columnist Margaret Sullivan. Then,
this represents the darkest part of the Bureau's history.
The FBI's actions from more than 50 years ago come under new scrutiny in a film about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Why did the Bureau obsessively spy on the civil rights leader? On King's 92nd birthday, we speak to the film's director, Peabody winner, Sam Pollard. And
the pandemic has really set women back.
Women bearing the economic brunt of the crisis. Our Walter Isaacson talks with philanthropist and author Melinda Gates on helping the most vulnerable. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. President-elect Joe Biden says that come Wednesday, America will start a new chapter. But the country is still reckoning with a homegrown threat in the days leading up to his inauguration. Washington, D.C. is in lockdown now as officials warn of the potential for domestic terrorism. The danger underscored by new details from last week's insurrection on Capitol Hill. Correspondent Shimon Procupes spoke to several police officers about what they were up against that awful day.
In last week's deadly coup attempt at the U.S. Capitol, a pro-Trump mob swarmed the building, outnumbering and battling police officers fighting to defend it. D.C. Metro Police Officer Michael Fanone was in this group of officers at the west front entrance of the Capitol as rioters forced their way in. They eventually push him out into the crowd where Fanone says he was tasered several times. While trapped, the 40-year-old says he thought about using his gun to fight back. This horrifying video shows the moment the violent mob storms into a tunnel of the building, trapping and crushing DC Metro Police Officer Daniel Hodges by a door. Hodges miraculously leaving the attack without any major injuries, saying he was shocked. Some rioters thought authorities would be on their side. The insurrectionists even using unusual means in their efforts to break into the most secure areas of the U.S. Capitol building.
So that cognitive dissonance he talked about and that ecosystem is really because many of these extremist groups have been organizing online, where hate speech has flourished and social media companies have now struggled to keep up. So how do you balance free speech with the demands of national security and indeed protecting a constitutional democracy? Joining me to discuss are Ali Soufan, a former FBI agent, and Margaret Sullivan, a media columnist for The Washington Post. They both join me from New York, and I really want to talk to you both about this because I don't know what went through your mind listening to those police officers recount the terrifying ordeals that they went through on that day. But something in the ecosystem drove them into such a frenzy, and as one of them, you know, gently said, cognitive dissonance between truth and facts, that this is what happened. Margaret, I wonder whether you can just describe it from what we've talked about, the online organization.
So, you know, this is a what's being called the big lie. And the big lie is that the election was rigged and that there was widespread fraud. And this is something that President Trump has been laying the groundwork for since long before the election. And right-wing media, pro-Trump media, has taken up this idea. And so it has circulated among the public very widely, but also there's a whole underworld of online social media and other ways of communicating that are, you know, underneath the surface. So both, I think, on the surface, you can turn on Fox News, and underneath the surface, most of us aren't on 4chan, but it's happening there and in other places mm-hmm. like that. And it's very widespread. So, and then, of course, it's being echoed and magnified by our elected officials, many of whom have propagated this big lie. And so it's become, we can see that it's not a case of no harm, no foul with this. And yes, of course, there are free speech issues here. But I think that many of them are being presented in bad faith. Oh, it's a cancel culture. You mustn't exert any effort to restrain this. And that's just not the case.
Well, let's move on to Ali Soufan about this, because, you know, you have real life experience in dealing with this kind of extremism, different kinds, not domestic terrorism mostly. And you recently wrote in your newsletter, if President Trump is allowed to successfully sow discord, having already compromised security by stalling the transition process and undermining President-elect Biden, he may do more long-term damage to the United States than even adversaries like Al-Qaeda and ISIS were able to inflict. I have to say, that's a shocking conclusion, and I'd like you to explain why you think that.
Well, what happened last Wednesday was a strike on the heart of our democracy. It further divided us. Frankly, Trump reduced the political discourse in America, including the media coverage, to a spectator sport. Real professional journalism, factual press, moderate voices, became dim and boring and deemed increasingly undesirable. Not to say that there are a lot of publications like the Washington Post and the New York Times and others who continue to do a good expose of him. But in general, in the last 4 years, we've seen the middle disappear. Unfortunately, many in the media became to exist in two partisan bubbles that were mostly speaking to each other, but not to the American people, and certainly not to the centrist or the center and the moderates in the middle. Christian, for years now, for 4 years, we've witnessed a societal descent towards his level, towards his divisive nature. We became more and more tribal in our everything, even in wearing a mask during a deadly pandemic. And unfortunately, yes, we heard about social media, but also media in general often amplified, even normalized the lies and the conspiracy and the hateful, divisive rhetoric from Trump. And I agree with Margaret totally. Social media intensified the drift by profiting from algorithms. And their algorithm allowed and even promoted the absurd. So we became increasingly tribal. Tribalism led to division. Division led to hate. Hate led to rage. Rage led to insurrection. And I fear to come.
Well, let me move on then to Margaret about this, because it really is a case, as Ali just, you know, laid out, what led to everything in steps and then to what happened last week. So Jack Dorsey of Twitter has obviously banned Trump, and the others have taken him down. He's been deplatformed. But here's what Jack Dorsey has said. Having to ban an account has real and significant ramifications. I feel a ban is a failure of ours ultimately to promote healthy conversation. So let us talk about the ban. Margaret, from a free speech, a journalistic point of view, if you ban one, where does it stop? How many others who engage in the same kind of, well, similar kind of hate speech and conspiracy theories and lies and whipping up? Where do you end? So talk to us about the free speech aspect for the moment, Margaret.
Yes. Well, Christian, it's a very troubling question. And, you know, the social media companies and others in the media have been very reluctant to crack down on President Trump because he is the president. And so while you might say, well, those tweets are destructive and it's terrible the way he's insulting people or, whatever sort of havoc he was wreaking on Twitter, which was his favorite outlet, you still wanted to say, well, this is the president, we must let him speak. But there does come a point, and this is the point that Jack Dorsey is speaking about, in which essentially you are, you know, it's in a way not too dissimilar to the old idea of crying fire and shouting fire in a crowded theater. Mm-hmm. You're actually causing harm, causing something that, you know, we've seen the results of it, and it's very, very troubling. So while there are free speech issues, and I am a great advocate of the First Amendment and do not want to see this kind of thing overused, I think something had to happen here, and it was the proper and only answer to what was going on. But, you know, as you say, Margaret, then it has wide ramifications, mm-hmm. and those have to be thought through very carefully and worked out, and I don't think we should overdo it.
Just to get it clear, the First Amendment protects ordinary people from the government, right? It doesn't necessarily protect a government from misusing whatever their speech platforms. It's for people like us who don't have the power that a government does.
Well, and it's also for news organizations and media organizations who the government might want to crack down on. So that's been important aspect of it. But no, you're right. It isn't intended to protect the president of the United States as he incites violence among his rabid followers. No.
Now, Ali Safwan, I want to ask you, because, you know, a lot of people in your business, in the security business, are very concerned that this looks like, a movement that is akin to domestic terrorism. And it has a spiritual and operational leader who happens to be the president of the United States. I'm quoting some members in law enforcement and national security. So in your mind, given that, how does deplatforming reduce the threat, or does it further anger the acolytes? Is it a recruiting tool for the acolytes? How does it work?
I think, you know, they're going to go somewhere else. They're going to try to follow him somewhere else. I'm sure some platform will allow him to use their technology to spread hate. But we need to counter this in a strategic way. We need to do it in a unified way as a nation. The vice president here have a huge role to play. Everyone who voted for Trump, everyone who voted for the Republican Party, frankly, voted also for Vice President Pence. He was on each and every one of these ballots, and he needs to face the wider public and expose the truth and the lies of the president regarding the election and regarding his task for Stop the Steal. Also, on the same time, law enforcement, we need to wake up. We've been warning about this for more than 2 years, about the spread of white supremacy, not only in the United States, but the international connections that they have, the transnational nature of this threat. We have to counter it in exactly the same way we countered the so-called jihadi threats before. It's happening in our 50 states. It is serious. It presents a clear and present danger to the security of the United States, but also to the republic. And it is now targeting the foundations of our republic. And so many people in Congress need to stand up and start looking into their followers and telling them the truth. I support all these private sector entities that's firing these people and kicking them out. I think the president is complaining that he was fired from Twitter. Well, he's a reality TV star that made his business and made his reputation about telling people he's fired. So now America is telling you, you're fired, get the hint.
And Margaret, let's take a step back a little bit, because, of course, it's not just social media, as you have written so eloquently and frequently about. It is, in fact, mainstream media, if you call Fox News mainstream media and that kind of stuff. And you have called them out over and over again. I mean, whether it was in ginning up support for the Iraq war or whether it was being the voice of President Trump, essentially. You said, to put it bluntly, the mob that stormed and desecrated the Capitol on Wednesday could not have existed in a country that hadn't been radicalized by the likes of Sean Hannity, Tucker Carlson, and Laura Ingraham. So, I mean, you're naming names there, and you are pretty sure that this has been a long time coming in plain sight.
That's right. And in the same column, which you read a line or two from, I also call out the names of Rupert Murdoch and Lachlan Murdoch and Suzanne Scott, who is in charge of Fox News. And, you know, these are people who have fomented this kind of outrage that has and allowed very misleading and very toxic kind of information to circulate. And they've done so under a very misleading banner. As you may recall, when Fox was first on the air, the idea was, and the motto or the slogan was, fair and balanced. Well, that has been misleading from the start. And it's been a very destructive force in our society, and it has radicalized many people, maybe not to the point where they're going to go to the Capitol and participate in a riot, but certainly in undermining the truth. And that is a very serious thing in a democracy, because what we need in a democracy is a common set of facts that is generally accepted and that we all function from, although we may have different opinions about what to do about it.
Exactly. And that is so important. And before we get to potentially some solutions, I want to ask Ali about the cause and effect, because, you know, you listen to these people and you listen to some of the Congress people who actually voted to certify, Republicans who voted to certify, obviously, the election and then voted to impeach the president this time around. They are faced with constituents, many of them, who genuinely believe this nonsense that Margaret has been, you know, talking about, that genuinely believe the lies that have been perpetrated on mainstream media and on social media, whether the regular social media or the deep dark web or whatever. They really believe it. And so they went in to try to save their democracy. How do you, from a law enforcement perspective, deal with the message and the effect of that message?
That's a very good question. And you have to separate, you know, the signal from the noise. Not everyone who went on that day to D.C. Wanted to participate in an insurrection, wanted to destroy our republic. But there are few organizations and groups and networks who really were there just to do that. And this is a job now of law enforcement, to separate the protected speech from the insurrectionists and from the violent extremists. And unfortunately, these members of Congress, to include, I'm not talking, he's not a member of Congress, but also the vice president, need to face up this big, you know, probably millions of people in America who, exactly like Margaret said, has been brainwashed totally by some of the Fox News personalities and by the president. They need to face them and tell them the truth about what happened. Those people looked the other way in Charlottesville in 2017 when the president said good people on both sides. Those people looked the other way during the Tree of Life synagogue attack in 2018. They are the same people who also looked the other way and normalized the 2019 El Paso attack at a Walmart targeted Latinos. Also spoke of an invasion by foreigners in the same terminology as President Trump and the folks on Fox News. And finally, they want us to totally normalize the message, his message, the president's message to the Proud Boys to stand back and stand by. Well, they did. And then they listened to him again when he told them to attack Congress, to walk up Pennsylvania Avenue, to take back their country. And they did. And some of these Proud Boys, shockingly, were wearing T-shirts with 6MWE, which means 6 million wasn't enough, per referring to the victims of the Holocaust. This have to stop. These people in Congress need to be held accountable. We are here because of them. The damage that we're facing, the weakness that we're facing, the horrible impact on our democracy today and our image overseas is not because of Al-Qaeda, is not because of ISIS, it's not because of North Korea or Saddam Hussein is Putin. Is because of them. We need to hold them accountable so we can be a better nation, a stronger nation, and our democracy can survive.
And Margaret, of course, this has damaged America's image overseas profoundly, and the reputation of America has been sinking dramatically over the last 4 years, and particularly over last week. Obviously, there's a lot of hope for a new administration to try to reset the situation. But from your perspective and all the studies you have done and the commentary and the columns you've written about the press in real time, do you think that anybody's learned a lesson? Do you see a solution that could, you know, do you see any solution out there from the press itself? For instance, should the president, particularly one who does not deal in facts or truth, simply because he's American president, be given, you know, unending airtime?
Right. Well, you know, those are deep and complicated questions, but I will say that even during the coronavirus briefings, I did write a column that said these should not be taken live by the networks because they are full of damaging lies. And I think no one's suggesting, oh, don't tell people what the president said, but we have to provide context in real time. We should not be providing a platform for damaging lies. And I so appreciate Ali's passion. He's absolutely right. And this is something that we really have to grapple with in the days and weeks ahead. Trumpism and all that implies does not go away on January 20th. This is something that we have to be dealing with into the future. And I'm actually writing a column right now that suggests a few solutions for the mainstream press, what I like to call the reality-based press. So I am thinking about it too.
Well, good, and we will definitely post that when you publish it. Margaret Sullivan, Ali Soufan, thank you so much. Now, as we've heard, the FBI plays a vital role, of course, in protecting the American homeland. So, why more than 50 years ago did the FBI abuse its authority to spy on one of the most famous, most important civil rights leaders of all time? That question is at the heart of a revealing new film, looking at the Bureau's ugly obsession with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Here's a clip from MLK FBI featuring King's close friend and speechwriter Clarence Jones.
Free at last! Free at last! Thank God Almighty! We are free at last!
After Dr. King gave his famous March on Washington speech, Wednesday, August 28, 1963. In a memo dated the 30th of August, no later than that, the second person in the FBI, it may have been Sullivan, sends a urgent memo in which he says, after the March on Washington, it's clear that Martin Luther King Jr. is the most dangerous Negro in America. And we have to use every resource at our disposal to destroy him.
It's shocking to hear all these years later, and the man behind this film is Peabody winner and Oscar nominee Sam Pollard. He's directed other acclaimed documentaries like Sammy Davis Jr., I've Gotta Be Me, and he's edited several Spike Lee joints, including Mo Better Blues and Jungle Fever. And Sam Pollard joins me right now from New York. Welcome to the program. It really is an extraordinary film. It's really shocking to trawl back into those FBI archives and see what they did. What was the impetus for you to do it? Obviously, the actual tapes don't get released, I think, for another 7 years. Why did you want to do this now?
Well, in 2017, Christiane, my producer and I, Benedine, had read a book written by David Garrow, the historian David Garrow. They looked at Dr. King and how the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover were surveilling him from 63 up until his assassination. And as soon as we finished reading that book, we said, this is a film. And we reached out to Garrow. We took an option on his book. And I happened to know David Garrow. He was one of our consultants on Eyes on the Prize. And we went to Pittsburgh, where he lived, and we took a camera crew along with us. And we spent over 4 hours with David, having him talk about the book and why he wrote the book and the information in the book, which became the frame for telling the story about King and the FBI and Hoover.
So tell us then, I mean, you sort of unpack this this awful story, which pitted, you know, the most powerful law enforcement against the civil rights leader. Why did J. Edgar Hoover, and it comes across in your film, hate Martin Luther King so much?
Well, he hated Dr. King because he was a black man who galvanized a group of thousands and thousands of people to come to Washington. He gave this phenomenal speech, I Have a Dream. And for J. Edgar Hoover, he became the most dangerous Negro in America. And why was that? Because he was saying, Dr. King and his associates were saying, African Americans no longer want to be on the margins of American society. They wanted to be part of, integrated into American society. And for J. Edgar Hoover and for many white Americans, that was anathema. All of a sudden, black people want to be integrated. They want to sit in front of the bus. They want to be able to drink from white water fountains. He didn't understand that. So he basically got the approval of Bobby Kennedy to start to wiretap Dr. King, because the first thing he considered that Dr. King was flirting with communism because of his relationship with Stanley Levinson. And then after they started wiretapping King and his associates, they learned that King had a very complicated personal life that involved him being in with other women. So then they turned their lens to that direction, figuring if they could document King's sort of very complicated personal life, they could use that to defrock him, discredit him, and destroy his reputation.
I mean, and it was intense because basically the FBI sent a letter with tapes of these indiscretions. And one of the letters suggested to Coretta King, you know, he should kill himself for the sake of the movement and for the sake of the country. How successful in real time was the FBI's effort to discredit Dr. King? How successful was their effort to, you know, drive a wedge into his marriage and into his family life?
They weren't successful. I mean, you know, obviously the press at that time in the 60s didn't grab onto people's personal lives. They didn't use those things against, you know, our professional celebrities. And so it didn't work. I mean, you know, imagine William Sullivan, one of J. Edgar Hoover's closest confidants, creating this letter, supposed to be a person, a black person, and basically intimating that King should kill himself. Then on top of that, they send the tape that's supposed to be King in the situation with another woman to his wife, Coretta Scott King. Now, obviously they were hoping that it would destroy his marriage, it would destroy his, you know, his sort of tenure in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, but it didn't. But it had to, from my perspective, it had to wear on Dr. King emotionally and psychologically. I mean, he's dealing constantly with the movement. He's dealing with the fact that he's being surveilled. Now he's dealing with the fact that the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover would go to such lengths to try to destroy him. It had to be very intensely, you know, oppressive on him.
And you can see that. You can definitely see that in your film. And, you know, he's dealing, as you said, with everything and being a global figure while this was going on in the background. Interesting that the press did not take the bait from the FBI at that time. And I wonder whether you think things would have been completely different had this all happened, you know, today.
I think it would have been 100% different. If this kind of information had come out about King today, they would have taken it like a dog with a bone. You know, and it's, but what's also kind of fascinating, though, is that even though there's, the press has sort of dug into people's scandalous lives like Mr. Trump, it didn't seem to stick. It hasn't stuck. All the scandalous information that came out about Donald Trump, the audio tapes, you know, before before the election for the presidency, none of that has stuck. So who knows? But I think with Dr. King, it probably would have stuck.
That's interesting, that comparison. I want to ask you, because you're obviously, you know, you're a supporter. You were just a child when he was alive. He is a saint. I mean, he's become a saint for all the right reasons. Do you worry about putting this out and maybe his reputation being somewhat, I don't know, not his whole reputation, but people thinking that perhaps some of the shine was off the prize there? Or is it important to you to show him as a man?
It was very important to me as a filmmaker to show him as a man. But, you know, myself and my producer, Ben Hadeen, we asked ourselves that same question. Well, we're going to hurt Dr. King's reputation, even though we want to show him as a human being. My answer to that is that I don't think it will. I don't think it will take this shine off of his reputation at all. I think that, you know, he will always be revered as one of the greatest contributors to helping America become a country that found the right footing. Now, the challenge is that there will be Americans who never thought much of Dr. King. And if these tapes come out in 2027, that'll just reaffirm their sort of hate and distrust of Dr. King and what his movement was all about. Because, as you know, it radically changed what America is. I mean, I grew up thinking America was the beacon of light, not knowing that it really was a very hypocritical nation.
And interestingly, and I hadn't known this either, but the film obviously tells us that back at that time, I mean, maybe it's not so surprising, that the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover were way more popular amongst people, ordinary people, than Martin Luther King. The FBI, you know, inspired a whole load of television programs that sort of glorified what they did and all the rest of it. Talk to me about that as well. I mean, when all this was happening, and certainly when Martin Luther King was being accused of being a communist, that must have also chipped away more at his, at his standing with people as he was trying to launch this civil rights movement for equality.
Well, remember, I mean, in 64, when they took a poll, you know, J. Edgar Hoover was more popular than Dr. King in 1964. Mm-hmm. I grew up at the time, 1964, where I thought the FBI were fantastic. I mean, I loved watching all these movies with Jimmy Stewart and John Wayne about the FBI fighting communism. I used to watch this ABC show with Efren Zemlis Jr. called the FBI. You know, I thought they were America's national police that was doing right. They were ferreting out the bad guys to do justice in America. So, you know, it was an America where the propaganda that was developed, the mythology around the FBI that was developed, was really done extremely well, that even a young African-American boy, a teenage boy, thought they were phenomenal. Even though I respected Dr. King, you know, I was saying to somebody, in many African-American households back then, we had three images on our walls. We had Martin Luther King, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, and Jesus Christ.
All right. Did J. Edgar Hoover really believe that Dr. King was a communist? I mean, did they really believe that communism was sweeping through the black community? I want to play this little clip from your film, and it is Dr. King talking about this issue.
I would hope that the FBI would come out and say something that I think is much more significant. And that is that it is amazing that so few Negroes have turned to communism in the light of that desperate plight. I think it is one of the amazing developments of the 20th century, how loyal the Negro has remained to America in spite of his long night of oppression and discrimination.
Well, you know, think of it this way. J. Edgar Hoover was obsessed with the Communist Party. You know, he wanted to believe that even when the Communist Party was attracting African Americans, that there were no racial problems in America. You know, how absurd is that? You know, there was no racial problems in America. He was concerned that communism would undermine American democracy. As we know, the Red Scare was you know, proliferated all through America in the 50s. You know, so he believed in it. And he believed also very, very seriously, and like lots of Americans, like from my perspective, lots of white Americans, that black people should be happy where they were. Why are they trying to push the envelope? You know, why don't they take their time? I mean, it's amazing to realize how we were considered just marginal in American society and American history.
And obviously we're talking in the midst of this unbelievable chaos that's happening in American society, culture, and politics, with racism and with this insurrection and with the pandemic and with just such a confluence of events. And the FBI now, of course, is focusing on domestic terrorism, and they think that's the biggest threat to the United States. I want to play a little clip, because you did actually interview the former FBI chief, James Comey, and this is what he said.
Have you read that letter?
Yes, I have. I was sick to my stomach, actually. I mean, I didn't throw up, but I felt ill reading it. And that's what I mean when I say I think this entire episode represents the darkest part of the Bureau's history.
Of course, that's the letter that we referred to in the opening clip, right? When they said he's the most dangerous person in America. What do you think? And actually, just also to say, you didn't really show any of the contributors until the very, very end. It was really interesting how they were all covered with pictures, and you didn't show their faces until the very, very end. It was pretty cool, that. I want to know why you did that. But is there anything that you or James Comey thought that the FBI could do to make this right, if there's any such thing to be done?
Well, I've been asked, do I think the FBI will ever apologize for what they did to Dr. King? And my response is no, they'll never apologize. I just don't think that's going to be a part of in their DNA. And then also from my perspective, I know that Mr. Comey says it was the darkest time in the chapter of the FBI, but I'm too cynical to believe there aren't other dark chapters in the history of the FBI, quite honestly.
All right, on that note, Sam Pollard, MLK FBI, it's an amazing film, and IFC Films is releasing that in select theaters and on streaming services today, which is, in fact, Dr. King's birthday, and he would have been 92 years old. We turn to the pandemic now and the huge toll it's taking on women. Women's jobs are nearly twice as vulnerable as men's during this crisis. And of course, while women lose paid jobs, they are taking on more unpaid work in the home, like homeschooling of their children and caring for their family members. And so the release of the paperback edition of Melinda Gates' book, The Moment of Lift, How Empowering Women Engages and Changes the World, is particularly timely. And here she is talking to our Walter Isaacson about this issue and the all-important COVID vaccine.
Thank you, Christiane and Melinda Gates. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Walter.
Your new book out in paperback, The Moment of Lift, is about the empowerment of women. And yet this coronavirus pandemic seems to be a great setback for that. In fact, in the last jobs report, men gained about 16,000 jobs, but women lost 140,000 jobs. Why is that, and what can we do?
Yes, the pandemic has really set women back. And, you know, when I wrote this book in 2019, we thought we were moving forward for women. But what the pandemic has done in terms of jobs are two things. One is women in society in the United States quite often hold those low-wage jobs with people in their homes now not going out and getting services and as many of the goods as before. Those jobs have been lost. So that's one. The other is women are doing an inordinate amount of childcare at home. It's right here in our faces. They're helping kids who aren't in school keep their homework up. They're getting the meals on the table. They're doing the laundry. That childcare work and even some of the elder care is making women step back in their careers because they're saying, I just can't do it all.
You know, the caregivers, the role that women are playing in that, that's something I think you've urged both in writing and maybe in conversations with President-elect Biden, that we have a czar that oversees how we do caregiving.
Yes, absolutely. I've spoken with President-elect Biden about that several times, and he sees the importance of this child care sector and as well the elderly care. I mean, he was a dad who lost his wife and raised two sons while he was a senator. He understands how hard that is, and he thinks of this child care as the infrastructure for our economy. He knows that we can't build back and have a swift recovery unless we can get women back into the labor force. And that means having things like a good paid family medical leave policy.
How do you and Bill differ? What do you bring differently in the way you approach the foundation that you co-founded?
Well, I think both of us, you know, have a huge commitment to the foundation. We share the same values in terms of what the foundation does. Bill has, not surprisingly, one of his gifts is a very technocratic focus. It's something that benefited him enormously at Microsoft and I think benefits the work at the foundation. I think I bring a bit more of the listening and human perspective. I think it's, we both travel in the field, but I think what I've heard so often from men and women in villages and in very crowded cities about what they need, I can balance the, when we have a new tool, say for family planning or a new vaccine, the distribution piece of how do we get people to accept that technology or what's right for them and how do we think of it from a full family perspective? Because I see what it takes to raise children. I hear from women what they need and honestly what holds them back from even being able to take up these new tools.
To what extent has the pandemic set back the goals that y'all are doing at the foundation?
Yes, it set many of them back enormously. You know, poverty was on the decline around the world. It's now on the rise again. Hunger is on the rise. Hundreds of millions of children are out of school. Those are going to have long-term and lasting implications on the field of global health, global development, and poverty elimination. And so we have a lot of work ahead of us as a global health community.
You and Bill have been focused on polio vaccines, almost eradicating polio. What have you learned from that that applies to our vaccine situation now? And why is our vaccine situation rollout going so badly, in your opinion?
Well, I think one of the benefits, I will say, of the polio vaccination program is we've learned what it really takes to spread true information and get people to accept things like polio drops. It also has left an enormous infrastructure across a country, say like Nigeria, that benefits then other vaccines when they come in. Great laboratories, good scientists, good community acceptance. So there's lots there, lots of rails we can build on from polio and other vaccine campaigns. The reason I think we have such a lumpy distribution of vaccines, quite honestly, in the United States, or that I know, is that the current CDC was not used in the function that it was set up to be used. It was set up to really give advice to health commissioners in every single district in the United States. Because they were set aside, we now don't have a federal plan for distributing vaccines. We have 50 different state plans, and that just should not be. You want a mass coordinated effort to make sure that first our healthcare workers get vaccines, then our most vulnerable populations. And we just don't have a federal response today, and that is a shame.
Why is it important that we make sure that the whole world gets vaccinated rather than focus on ourselves?
Yes, if we don't ensure that low and middle income countries also have great vaccine, great amounts of vaccine, what's going to happen is we're going to see this disease continue to bounce around the world in country after country. So we might eliminate it for a time in the United States or in Europe, but as it's bouncing around the world, it will come back inside our borders. And what it means is more death around the world. And what it also means is a much slower recovery in places like the United States or Europe, because our supply chains will continue to be messed up. Our travel industry won't go back. Our manufacturing industry won't go back as quickly as it could. So it just makes not only ethical sense, but economic sense to make sure low and middle income countries also have widespread vaccination.
One of the vaccines that you pushed with the Gates Foundation was the Oxford-AstraZeneca one. And that's now been approved for emergency authorization in England. Do you think we should speed it up here so that can get approval?
I think that the FDA is a fantastic regulatory body, and I think they will roll it out in the United States when they feel they have all the right data for our population. And yes, our foundation's been behind about a half dozen vaccines. That's because we need lots of different tools for around the world. Particularly, it's going to benefit low and middle income countries when we have vaccines that are single dose and that don't require the vast cold chain that Moderna or the Pfizer vaccine required. Thank God we have those two vaccines, but to distribute it out everywhere it needs to go in the world, we need some of these vaccines that will be a little bit easier to distribute.
Some of the pushback against vaccines is very odd, especially the paranoid, wacky conspiracy theories that involve you and your husband and the Gates Foundation on vaccines. What do you make of those? How did those happen and how can you fight them?
Well, disinformation is always disturbing, and it's disturbing because it causes death. And so what I tell people is talk to your doctor. I mean, you're going to put a biologic tool in your body. So, of course, there's going to be some hesitancy. That makes sense. And this is a new tool. It is a safe tool. But when you talk to your doctor, he or she knows what's right for you or for your children. And so we just have to give people sensible information. The good news, Walter, is that the vaccine hesitancy is already starting to go down. And I think it was high because of the spread of disinformation. I think it was high because there's a lot of anxiety in society right now. We're all home. We're all worried about this disease. But I think as you start to see more people getting vaccines, we're already hearing, at least in Seattle, people clamoring for vaccines. And I think it's going to roll out once we get past some of these distribution bumps quite readily. I think people are going to accept the vaccine.
You and Bill have talked to incoming President Joe Biden a few times and talked to his team a lot. What are you pushing for him to do on this pandemic?
We're pushing President-elect Biden to make sure there is a national, federally led, coordinated testing and tracing plan, and as well a nationally led vaccination plan. And I have to be honest, it doesn't take much pushing. He already knows that is needed. He knows he wants and needs to empower the CDC fully. And he's got great advisors around him who are already planning to do that. We've also obviously talked with him about climate change and its importance on the long-term agenda, and as well this childcare infrastructure that needs to be rebuilt.
One of the things that you do is you always go on site to see what the foundation is doing, especially in places like Africa and India. And recently you've been taking Jen, your oldest daughter, and there's a wonderful tale in the book about blankets and how she wanted to give blankets as a young kid. And then another tale about the headlamp she was wearing and how you realize you can empower girls who had trouble with their homework. Tell us about those.
Sure. So when Jen was about 15, we went and stayed with a family who welcomed us into their home in rural Tanzania. And it was amazing several days we spent with them. And I think one of the things that really struck my daughter Jen and me at the time was how many chores the women had to do. You know, we cooked over the fire, we chopped firewood, we put dinner on the table. But then at 10 at night, we were out under the stars doing the dishes. And one of the girls in the family, her twin brother, had made it on to secondary school. She had not yet passed her exams. She had not passed them the first time, and she was studying to pass them the second time. She was very shy, but she was about also 15. As soon as my Jen came out of our hut with her headlamp on, this girl, Grace, went straight to my daughter Jen and said, "When you leave, can I have your headlamp?" And Jen said, "Of course you can." And she said, "Why?" And she said, "Because when we're finished with the dishes at night out here, I could then go study for my exams." And it just shows you all this unpaid labor that girls do. Her brother was doing his studies in the afternoon when he came home from school. But the difference that a girl has in her life because of all this unpaid labor, or the difference if she has a headlamp so she can study and empower herself, it makes a profound difference.
You talk about prioritizing women's leadership. How has that been set back by the pandemic, and what can we do?
Well, women, first of all, must have a seat at the table at everywhere that decisions are being made. So whether that's policy making in politics and in our halls of Congress or in our state houses, whether those are decisions being taken on Wall Street, whether those are decisions in the tech industry, which is changing all of society, or in media that's telling our stories, when you have women and people of color with a seat at the table, with a full voice and decision-making authority, they make different decisions on behalf of society because they see society in its fullness and richness. So just as one example for women in politics, what do we need to do? Not just train women in how to enter political office, but show them opportunities, open our networks to them, and make sure they're funded. And to be frank, we can do that in all industries. We can create pathways in to things like tech and finance in ways that are pretty blocked for women today.
Why are there so few women in technology?
Because at the time I was in college, late 1980s, I'm dating myself here, women were on the rise in computer science. I'm a computer science major. And then it went precipitously downward. And it's because the personal computer was introduced as a game for young boys. And boys became quite interested in it. The games were shoot 'em up games, which girls weren't interested in it. And the more boys you got into it, the more boys and men you got into it. And now it's become so genderfied that people think, oh, well, women can't be coders. We don't see women as coders. We don't have a class in college that welcomes women in. So that first freshman class in college that's computer science, if a woman hasn't studied computer science in high school, she doesn't feel welcome because the boys have been programming for so long. Whereas if you have a class, like many universities are starting to have, an opening freshman class that are real world problems, women will not only get into it, they'll get interested and they'll stay in computer science. And so we need to change that, and we need to change the computer industry so that women-led businesses are funded, which they're not today by venture capitalists, and so that the computer science industry, the tech industry, welcomes women into those coding jobs more readily than they do today.
One of the powerful parts in your book is this chapter about the power of letting your heart break. Give me an example of where you and Bill had your heart broken.
I think both of us, I know both of us being out in low-income countries and seeing the great lengths that a mother or father will go to keep their child alive. We have both experienced that. We've both been in places where HIV was such a stigma that the person, even though the medications were available, wouldn't go get them. We've both sat and heard stories of unbelievable violence towards women or towards men who had HIV. Those stories break your heart, and I would say they enliven both of us to keep doing the work that we're trying to do with the foundation so that people can live a healthy and productive life.
Melinda Gates, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thanks for your questions, Walter. I really appreciate it.
So many important reminders from Melinda Gates, especially on the power of women. But finally tonight, the story of a racing pigeon that has captured the world's attention and has come to a happy ending. The Australian government says Joe the pigeon, who many believed had flown from Oregon, USA, to Melbourne, Australia, is not, after all, a risk to the country's bird life. Joe was found on the roof of a local homeowner, and he was named after President-elect Biden. He was thought to have travelled more than 8,000 miles from continent to continent. Australian authorities, though, were not taken by Joe at all, with the acting Prime Minister, Michael McCormack, suggesting the bird would have to be put down.
If Joe has come in a way that has not met our strict biosecurity measures, then bad luck, Joe. Either fly home or face the consequences.
Important matters of state, of course. But in a twist, it turns out that Joe isn't a Yank after all. He was an Aussie all along. And he's now, yup, free as a bird. And make sure to join us next week for our coverage around the inauguration of President-elect Joe Biden. We take a look back at what lies ahead in the new Biden era. That is it for now. You can always catch us online on our podcast and across social media. Thank you for watching and goodbye from London.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.